Session number 8985, Reel 3.
Mr. Parry, Reel 3.
But he stayed above the ground always and never took any shelter. And by his courage, he instilled courage into other people. We were getting very short of 100 octane fuel. In fact, we were very, very low, and the island was very low in flour supplies, and the Maltese basically lived on flour and olive oil and sardines, I think. And it was arranged, also ammunition, it was arranged to get two convoys, one from Gibraltar and one from Alexandria, at the beginning of June. And before, you see, they had to get within fighter range to get any fighter cover. Now, the Alexandria one never got near us. They turned back and went back to Alexandria. I don't know how many ships they lost. But the one from Gibraltar, we got, I think, six ships through. Fortunately, one carrying 100 octane petrol, one containing flour, one containing ammunition. What the others had, I don't know. But the crucial things were we did, in fact, get what was required in that way. And before going off to cover these ships, as soon as they were coming within range, because the Navy sent a very big escort with them as far as what I think is called the Sardinia Narrows. But then they, pretty well all of them, turned round and went back again because they couldn't endanger these things from German dive bombers and that sort of thing, torpedo bombers and that and the other. So they all went back. They had a fleet minesweeper, which I went on board later on, His Majesty's ship Hebe, which was a minesweeper and had a big hole in it, as far as I remember, but it got there. Now, when we were going, he had... this time we were living in St. Julian's Bay. Originally 601 Squadron had lived in a palace called Nashar, that's spelled N-A-X-X-A-R, Nashar Palace, and I think that was in the village of Nashar. It belonged to one of the palaces belonging to the Marquis of Sikluna. Anyway, my CO had guaranteed a naval officer's wife and child a passage to UK from Malta, provided she handed over her house to us. And so the officers of 601 moved into a house in St. Julian's Bay. He got her this trip out to UK. And we moved in there. And anyway, there was it was a very nice house, and there was a big open veranda and things. And I'm trying to emphasize the respect of which Sir Hugh Pugh Lloyd was held by the pilots that he came on, and his opening words were to us, "We have a convoy coming in. We have to get it in." And I'm not using his words, but, you know. "And we're prepared to sacrifice every one of you to get them in." And, well, I think everybody probably inside him went a bit pale and cold, but he could say that because he commanded so much respect. So probably that's really enough for me to say about Lloyd. He really was a marvellous man. The third one was the controller, Group Captain Woodall. He was the chief controller. I think his name was spelt the same as Woodall in Woodall's Bar. I think so.
Is that with or without an H?
I think it had an H, but I think. I can't honestly say that I've ever seen it in writing. But I do remember the first flight. I've digressed really about this. You know, I should go back and tell you that after my CO was supposed to have had it, Jimmy Peck came back. And I said, "I believe my CO's been shot down." He said, "I couldn't tell you." I said, "What's happened to Dennis Barnum?" He said, "Oh, he's had it." So that was the CO and the other flight commander gone in one go. In fact, neither of them had gone. The CO went into the sea, about 5 miles off Malta, got into his dinghy, and he was a great big man, I don't know, 6'2" or 6'3", big with it too. And he managed to paddle himself almost ashore, but Malta is basically pretty well everywhere's cliffs. And he was exhausted, he couldn't get any farther, and he was, the dinghy was hitting against rocks, and there was a navy bot of some sort who saw him and jumped off the cliff into the water and got him round to where he could be landed. And Bisty recommended him for a decoration, and they just said, well, you don't get decorations for like that on Malta. Anyway, he was in a fairly bad way. He hadn't been wounded, but he was in a pretty rough state. They put him in hospital for a while, and then off to St. Paul's Bay, where there was a sort of rest camp run by a bloke that used to be called Uncle. He was a flying officer. Bosworth, I think he was. Bosworth. Anyway, I've digressed on that. Barnum actually landed, I think, on Halfire Aerodrome, and the 109s came in and did him on the ground in no uncertain fashion. And I often laugh about that. He said he couldn't stand the noise, so he put his fingers in his ears so he couldn't hear the stuff. He was untouched. And observers said that the smoke from these bursting cannon shells and stuff, it was like running along in a cloud. He was not touched. So he came back all right, I might tell you.
When would that have been?
Right, that was the first flight in Malta, so that would be, I think we got there probably about the 20th of May, but it'll be, I can't honestly give you the date for that, but it was the beginning of May. Then in that afternoon, I went up with a man called Barton, who was an ex-Fleet Air Arm, and he'd had an argument with the Navy. He was known by several names, either Sailor or usually Admiral. I knew him as Admiral. Brilliant pilot. He certainly had a DSO, at least a DFC. I don't think, he might have had a DSO, he had a DFC certainly. He was subsequently killed after coming back in England by, he was at one of the operational training units and taking off with a pupil, and someone landed in the other direction. Really waste of a life, because he was a great pilot. Anyway, I went off with him on what was called aerodrome defence, which meant in this country, aerodrome defence meant you just stooged around just in case there were any opposition arrived. I could hardly keep up with this character. I mean, pretty well on full throttle to keep up with him. I heard Group Captain Woodall, which I can really go on to now, saying, you know, sort of, I'm not sure if he called him Bart or whether he called him Sailor or Admiral now, but he called him up anyway and, you know, and said, about 100 plus of the small jobs coming in over the Grand Harbour now, but don't worry about those. There's 50 of the big boys coming afterwards. The big jobs are the ones you want. Don't worry about the small ones.
And what did you mean by the small
Well, 109s, job? I mean, they were just like gnats around the place, you see, but they didn't produce any goods, really, by shooting one of them down. Or I suppose one was shot down, but the idea was to stop the bombing. And so the thing was that one was supposed to concentrate on the bombers. Well, to get at the bombers, of course, you had to get down through this cover, which was pretty scary. Anyway, he'd just casually said, okay, Woody. And then I heard him call up a man called Norman McQueen, who was in 249 and one of their top pilots. And And it was all Christian name stuff. Woody here, Norman, same story, you know, you better position yourself, you know, so in the sun or something. But Woodall had, again, that knack of making you feel safe. You weren't, of course, but he just had that, it's hard to say really, warm, confidential, fireside chat sort of voice. He was a marvellous controller, was Woodall. He really was. And he was there a long time. I mean, when I left, he'd been there a long time, and he was there, I think, a long time afterwards. He was, you know, group captains were, controllers were very short measure, you know, you just didn't have them. I mean, you probably had up to a squadron lead and occasionally a wing command, but he was group captain, which meant he was really the king of all controllers, I should think. I think that he... say, in my estimation. Now, of course, you can't, that is abroad. Well, not abroad, it's a very sharp, sort of small thing to say three people were responsible. Of course they weren't. I mean, the pilots were responsible, but those, without those three, Malta could easily have been lost, easily.
So, you were with 601 Squadron.
Yes.
On Malta. And you were usually based at which airfield?
Luka. All at Luka, except when we landed. We landed at Takali from the carrier.
And can you tell me about the equipment that you had in the squadron and how it performed?
Yes, we had Spitfire 5Cs. And they were equipped at that time, when we came from the carrier, they were equipped with four cannons. They were no good with four cannons. So two of them were taken out and went back to the old format of two cannons. And whatever we had, four machine guns, I think it was, two on each side, two in the wings on each side. Originally, that we with four cannons came in. It was an eight Browning machine guns, who spewed out bullets each of them. I forget the rate now. It's 1,200 or 1,500 a minute or something. It was a very rapid rate of fire. And the cannons we had were 20 millimeter cannon, Hispano cannons. I think they were. I think they're Hispanos. And anyway, they took them out and replaced, they kept two, then the others were machine guns. They were Azores Spitfires, were marvellous machines. There were big snags in Malta, like refuelling. They only had the petrol in 5 gallon. What you could call paraffin tins. You know, they were just small tins of stuff. That's how it arrived. And, of course, there were no bowsers to refuel from at all. I mean, they'd all been long since shot to pieces. So to refuel planes, they used to put a big funnel into the petrol tank with a chamois leather. It was a pretty big, I can't remember the size, but it was a big one, and then just pour cans in, and I think we used to take about 90 gallons, 90 or 95, and that's how they had to be, you know, that was from empty to full, and that's how they all had to be refilled, so it was a comparatively slow measure, where you could have, like a garage in like that, it didn't happen. And you had irks sort of passing up these tins and one standing pouring it in and you maybe others fetching and carrying, but it was a pretty slow process, really.
Were you ever grounded because you ran out of fuel?
No. We would have been all right to fly, even if that convoy hadn't have come in, but we'd have had to go back to, instead of 100 octane fuel, we'd have been flying on 83 octane, which would have meant the performance was very well, considerably reduced. I think the Spitfires were better than anything in the German opposition. They brought in eventually the Messerschmitt 109F there, with a personal reminiscence on that. Everything in Malta, in Maltese language, if anything is destroyed incidentally, they call it spitchered. Now don't ask me how it's spelt. We used to spell it S-P-I-T-C-H-E-R-E-D, you know, spitchered. And that meant, you know, well, broken or blasted or anything else. And they used to say, oh, spitchered. So I had come across the yellow-nosed Göring squadron, or Göring Geschwader or whatever it was called really, who were all picked pilots. They were either like the Richthofen Circus of the First World War. They were all top-class pilots. They came from Abbeville when I first met up with them in the early days of the sweeps. And they did me 3 days in a row. I had no damage to me, but I had two planes which were called Category C, which were not to fly again until they'd been fixed up, and one which was pretty badly damaged, but it could be still flown back to base from... We landed at West Malling in Kent, as a matter of fact, at that time. So I had I didn't like them very much. And blow me if they didn't arrive on a rest down into Sicily at what we used to call Catania. I suppose it should be Catania, but anyway. They arrived there, these yellow-nosed boys, and they not only arrived, but they came down with 109Fs, which was their latest mark at that time. And we used to call their leader Von Spitcher, because, I mean, they were good. They were really good, those blokes. And they had a lovely time, because we were really sitting ducks to a mob of their standard. There was, in fact, a little anecdote on that, a Rhodesian called Buchanan, Buck Buchanan, who was not in my squadron. I think he was in 249. He shot down one of these chaps one day, and the chap got out. He had a broken leg, and away before the Maltese. I mean, incidentally, if a German or Italian came down in Malta, his life was non-existent unless some of the services got there. The Maltese didn't go for this. I mean, they just tear them to pieces. I mean that quite seriously. They would do them with, I mean, just like what's going on in South Africa now with, you know, that would happen. I mean it.
Mob justice.
Yeah. Oh. So anyway, he was brought into hospital, and he did this business, you know, send for me, the great pilot whom he shot down, you know. I am a German ace, and all this sort of thing. So they sent Buchanan up to see him. I've forgotten his name. I must have known it at one time. But anyway, he was, in fact, one of their top boys. Then he sort of said, how many have you shot down? So Buchanan sort of put his nose in his mouth and said, well, I'm afraid you're the first. He went mad, this German. Just a beginner to shoot me down. So Buck said, well, you know, sort of, this is it. I'm only a learner. Just think how good our really... He was furious, I believe. I wasn't there, but I was told about that. Anyway,
You were talking about the superiority of the...
Well, the Spit
was over the German fighter.
They were a better, but they were much... there was a closer match when it came to the 109Fs when they came down. And, of course, they had not only the quantity of planes which they were putting in the air, but when they came from Sicily, which really not very far away, they used to gain height over there, you see, and they would come over very, very high, whereas we couldn't afford to send the small number of planes which we had available until we knew that these things were coming and what was coming. You see, if they did a fighter sweep over the place and no bombers, nobody took off, you see. I mean, they let them do it, waste their petrol. There was no point. It was only the bombers that were really wanted. So the controller had to sit in his den and sum up what was coming and when it was coming. So basically, that they were already over the top of you when you came up. We used to fly south into the sun and climb as fast as you could. But nevertheless, they could well have been still up sun. You see, the controller would tell you where these people were, but you were always at a disadvantage. And to get at the bombers anyway, you always had to go down either through this lot, or they would come. When they saw you going in for the bombers, they would drop on you. I think I told you in my letter, I can't really remember any detail about... You seem to be... Well, turning, twisting, turning and diving and just... There were no tactics used at all as such. Like when you came in to fly from the UK over France and that sort of thing, where you had definite tactics. You had a battle formation to fly in, and you know you had the squadrons stacked up into sun. But there was no such thing. You set off as a general rule with two of you. In pairs, and as soon as the action started, you're on your own. I mean, first, you couldn't keep your eye on, because you had to turn like maniacs. I mean, whereas it would have been a very serious thing if you'd have abandoned your number one in this part of the world, flying, you'd have been chewed up over it. But there, I mean, it was just... like an old-fashioned dogfight, except you were very outnumbered.
So it was just every man for himself?
Basically, yes.
So was there no point in making plans before you went up about what you'd do?
No, only to climb up as fast as you could into sun and then listen to the controller, who would tell you where they would tell you that, you know, the big jobs were coming in, you know, over so-and-so, you know, and that they'd tell you what height, he'd give you the height they were at, and he would tell you where all the others were, and you took it from there, and you made your own decisions.
Whilst you were there on Malta, what kind of success did you manage to register, both personally and the squadron?
I can't give you figures. As far as I was concerned, I got nothing that I could claim as a destroyed. I fired many times, but there's nothing that I could say that I shot down.
And how many times would you personally have gone up, do you think?
I was there for about, I don't know, July the 4th. It's easy to remember coming home. So it was, that was the whole of May and June, I suppose, but when did we get there? April the 20th, about. I think I might have said May, but I think it was April. You'll have it in on your list there. I was there approximately 3 months, a little less than that.
Yes, you put here 13th of April.
Yes,
for the 4th
right.
of July.
That's when, yes, right, that's Malta, yes. Right, well... We adopted a method there of flying every other day after a while. And I had the squadron one day and my CO had it the other day. When the CO was laid up after his hospitalisation, or whatever you like to call it, being put in hospital and then down to the rest camp, Dennis Barnum ran the other day. And... It did vary. Sometimes there was no opposition, but I should think that you probably flew every other day during that period, twice a day. Could have been more, sometimes it may have been four times, but then there were other days when you didn't fly at all. I mean, there was just, for some reason, they didn't come, so nobody flew. I also had amoebic dysentery, or clinical dysentery. Now, there's a thing which you will undoubtedly have heard of. They call it Malta dog there. The Gippo tummy is the other thing in Egypt. I don't know. I suppose it's fly bred, really. But the fields of Malta are terribly small. And they have huge stone walls built around them. And I say huge, I mean huge. You know, they could be 6 feet thick. They're, I presume, drywalling. But I believe, I've been told anyway, that there was no soil virtually on Malta at all, but the Phoenicians brought it. And it was to keep this soil in, which had been brought by a ship from somewhere, that they had all these. They are tiny, they're really tiny. I mean, I should think a field would be 100 yards square would be a comparatively large field. I don't know what it's like today. I should think it's probably the same. So you could never land unless you got on an aerodrome. I mean, there was no forced landing. In fact, a chap that had been in 266 Squadron with me, Howard, you were told you must always bring a plane back, otherwise you're before it, sort of idea. You must always get it back. Well, he just failed to make the runway, went into one of these fields, and he didn't die on the spot, but he died in hospital just afterwards. I mean, he had no chance. It was running into a brick wall. And the Maltese put human feces on their stuff to make the stuff grow. And so everything that we ate that was not out of a tin or something like that was always washed in Condy's crystals. Well, it was supposed to be, but an awful lot of us suffered from this Malta dog.
What was Malta dog?
Well, it was a dysentery, yes. And I happened to be, I probably should say this, lucky. Because I had a bad dose. I was put in hospital. I was really bad. And when you went to the lavatory, it was sort of like a jelly came out of it. It was too terrible, really. But it did actually prevent me from flying for a couple of weeks. So who knows? I mean, it might have been very lucky to get it. I look back on it and think it was lucky.
So
out of that, you can say you take a, well, suppose you, for one reason or another, you took 3 weeks out of that, and I probably flew 100 times in Malta. I mean, I'm guessing now, I don't know, but it would have been something like that. They were short, you see, they didn't last long, these things. You were up for maybe 20, 25, 30 minutes. They weren't like fighter sweeps here, which were also comparatively short compared with bombing stuff, when you might have been an hour and a half. But there it was short and sharp.
What kind of losses did 601 Squadron sustain whilst you were there?
Well, they were heavy. I don't remember, because you've got replacement pilots and you hardly knew them. You really hardly knew them because, you know, it wasn't like squadron life as such, which it was here when you all ate and drank together. You did eat together, certainly. But, well, some of you did, but if they were sergeant pilots, the only time you saw them was when you went to the aerodrome. So you hardly knew them. But I should think that we, in that time, we probably lost between 20 and 30. That's in one squadron.
And what about aircraft?
They flew in.